integrity in each of the services is also critical to a strong military. General Amos, I have become friends with Major James Wyrick, United States Marine Corps, who I sincerely believe is a man of integrity. Did you fear Major Wyrick at any point?
My name is James Wyrick, and this is Military Justice, my podcast about the system of justice that governs those who protect our nation.
In a series of morning tweets, President Donald Trump announced Wednesday he will bar transgender individuals from serving in the U.S. military. Trump wrote the military cannot be burdened with the tremendous medical cost and disruption that transgender in the military would entail.
The entire force, the entire chain of command, always has, will today, and will tomorrow, and always should treat every single soldier, sailor, airman, marine, Coast Guardsman, with dignity and respect for their service and the cloth of our nation, bar none. So that's where we stand as of today.
Welcome back to Military Justice. Thank you for being here again. This is another show that was really prompted by you, the listeners, about a week ago, depending on when you listen to this. So sometime in late July, President Trump sent out a couple of tweets, about three tweets, explaining that transgender service members would no longer be able to serve in the military. As soon as that happened, I was really deluged with a number of requests to discuss this topic. I mean, I understand the legal portion of it. That really isn't a very long part of the discussion. I think there's probably some legal landmines in that service members for the last year or so who were transgender were able to serve openly. And now, presumably, these tweets suggest that they are going to be kicked out. So I think there's some issues there. But the rest of it, as far as if the president decides to ban transgender individuals from joining the military, he's probably on solid legal footing for doing that. I'm not talking about the wisdom of any of those decisions, just the legal ability to do it. That being said, that's kind of a smaller part of a much larger issue. I think you'll really like the episode today. I was very fortunate to be a long time, at least a decade-long friend with Emma Shin. Emma is a retired Marine Corps officer, previously a grunt in her early life, and then a lawyer. That's where I met Emma. And for about just a little over the last year, she's come out as a transgender woman. So it's really fortunate that she shared her story with us and her point of view. I mean, she definitely has both the legal point of view and has lived through being a transgender service member. So I hope you enjoy this. I hope you find it informative. I really enjoyed talking to her. And I mentioned this in the interview, but you'll note that I have a bit of a bias. I admit to that. I think highly of Emma Shin. Emma helped me in times of need. And so I can't tell you that I'm absolutely neutral when it comes to service by transgender individuals because of my interactions with Emma. And so know that going in, but I still think we do a good job of covering this topic. And as always, thanks for being here. Welcome, Emma Shin. Thank you for being on the podcast today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
And just a disclaimer to the audience, to you, to everyone else, having been a friend and colleague of yours when we served in the Marine Corps and having kept in contact after both of our retirements, Wyrick has just been on tilt with anger over this issue since the president sent out these tweets, and especially the reaction on social media. So if you, the listener, sense some bias, it's there just because I've known Emma for so long. So that being said, Emma, tell us about yourself.
Where to start, right? Well, I think that since we're talking about trans issues, the best place to start is when I, first kind of figured it out or had the inkling of me being different than what my body suggested. And that was at about the age of 4. I have a very distinct memory. I was in my bathroom in Starkville, Mississippi, and I'm looking in the mirror, and there's this disconnect, this dissonance between what I'm seeing in the mirror and what I feel inside. So I've known from a very early age, despite maybe not having the right vocabulary or the terminology to describe how I felt, I knew that there was something different. I also, being raised in the Deep South and in a very conservative religious family, that wasn't quote-unquote okay, especially not at the time. Since then, my family has been amazingly supportive people. But at the time, in the 70s and the 80s and even in the 90s, that it wasn't okay for someone to be trans socially. So I did everything I could to bury those feelings and to quote-unquote prove that I was a man. And that's part of the reason why the Marine Corps was so attractive to me, because, I felt that, if anything was going to help me man up, being in infantry in the Marine Corps was certainly going to do it. Turns out that wasn't successful, strangely enough.
Well, not to suggest that you weren't successful as an infantryman. I mean, you had a long career there.
Yeah. I did half my career in the infantry enlisted and half my career as an attorney. Yeah, and my career was successful, but it wasn't successful in hiding that part of me or proving to myself or to anyone else that I was a man. And that's what I meant by it not being successful. How to really put this into words, because it's a challenge. It's kind of ineffable, that feeling, that disconnect. But it drove me to a lot of decisions. Like I said, from enlisting to choosing to go overseas, to choosing the infantry itself, and then ultimately becoming a Marine Corps officer, because I thought, that's the epitome of masculinity, or at least stereotypically it is. But what I didn't know is how amazing the Marine Corps would be for my life and the friends that I've made throughout my entire career, yourself included. But I've got friends from my initial enlistment, when I was stationed in Okinawa, Japan, that are still friends today. It's pretty amazing what the Marine Corps has done for me as a person.
Yeah, so you came out, or you started living as a woman just over a year ago, right?
Correct. Yeah, I went full-time July 9th, 2016.
Right, and I remember reading on Facebook, you came out and kind of gave your one-year synopsis, and I was pretty proud to be in this group of, friends and colleagues, that it seemed that your business grew, you had more clients, that you were accepted and greeted, with respect by opposing counsel and judges. It seemed like you had a pretty good first year.
Absolutely. I've had a stellar first year, to be honest. Yeah, all of the fears that I had regarding transitioning and letting the world know who I really was, the vast majority of them did not actually happen. They were just that. They were fears. But yeah, my practice has grown. I've been recognized in the community here in Denver. In fact, I'm about to receive the 2017 Attorney of the Year Award from the Colorado LGBT Bar Association. So yeah, it's been amazing. And like you said, kind of a recap of my 1 year as Emma, it's been amazing.
Yeah, and part of the military justice portion of this is your practice is almost exclusive or primarily defending service members, right?
Correct. Yeah, it's right now it's about 60-40, just it kind of goes in waves. But about 60% of my clients are service members, and the other 40% are civilians in state and federal court.
This episode of Military Justice is brought to you by the good people of Bonwi.com. That's Bonwi.com. Bonwi gets you the best hotel rates and up to 30% back in rewards. Bonwi.com is a travel site where you can book hotels and cars. They scan all the major travel sites to bring you the absolute lowest rates. In fact, they back their low rates with a 110% price guarantee. When you book through Bonwi.com, you also get up to 30% back in rewards points. Other travel sites only give you 2 to 10% at best. Rewards points can be used for airline tickets, hotel stays, and gift cards. These points have no restrictions, no blackouts, and no processing fees. Imagine booking 4 to 5 hotel nights and getting enough points to get a free airline ticket, additional free nights, or a $100 Amazon gift card. New members get 1,500 rewards points just for signing up. So learn more by visiting Bonwi.com. Again, that's Bonwi.com. And start saving money on hotels and getting up to 30% back in rewards. We want to thank the people from Bonwi for supporting Military Justice. And remember, when you support our sponsors, you're supporting the podcast. Are we coming up on the week anniversary of Trump, President Trump's tweets now? So he says, after consultation with my generals and military experts, please be advised that the United States government will not accept or allow, and then ellipses. I like, he's just leaving us hanging there. So we get to the next tweet. Transgender individuals to serve in any capacity in the U.S. military. Our military must be focused on decisive and overwhelming victory and cannot be burdened with the tremendous medical cost and disruption that transgender in the military would entail. Thank you. Overwhelming cost.
Yeah. Well, actually, let's back up just a second.
Sure.
So the word burdened, right? This is that we can't be burdened with these costs and the disruption. Well, what I can tell you is that transgender service members are not a burden in any capacity. We've been serving, albeit not openly, but in the U.S. military since its founding. You know, there's some historical examples that I won't, you know, it's kind of outside the scope of this conversation, but there have been trans people serving in the U.S. military since 1775. And I think it's unfortunate to categorize our service as a burden when the facts don't support that. And so going to the facts, you know, talking the first, you know, first piece is that medical cost, the quote unquote tremendous medical cost. And, you know, unpacking those three words is actually kind of easy when you look at the facts and figures. You know, there are approximately 1.4 million service members on active duty and reserve at any given time. And there's about 1.4 million trans people in the U.S. at this current, you know, that's the most recent estimate. And what's really interesting is that transgender people tend to volunteer for military service about twice the rate of cisgender counterparts, or our people who cisgender, for those of you who aren't familiar with that term, it means that you identify with the gender that was assigned to you at birth, right? So if you're, you know, if you appear male, you feel male, right? Right. That's what cisgender means. So when you look at the population size of transgender service members right now, you know, the statistics, you know, estimate between 10,000 and 15,000 people actively serving right now. So it's a relatively small population of our entire U.S. forces. And the medical costs associated with that are also relatively low. You know, there's been some talk from socially conservative think tanks that have wildly overestimated the cost, you know, using every single possible surgery or medical cost associated with being trans and applying that to every single service member. That's just not the way that it works. Some people only socially transition. Some people choose to go on hormone replacement therapy or HRT. And some people choose to have surgical procedures done to help their body match what their brain is telling them. But everyone's transition is their own. And so there's not like one, you know, one size fits all approach when it comes to trans people and the cost of their healthcare.
Right. So if you have a member who is just socially transferring, there's no medical cost, right?
Right. I mean, there may be, you know, a very small cost regarding like counseling, right? If the person goes and talks to a therapist to help them in their journey. But I mean, almost negligible. So it goes from almost negligible to, you know, $50,000-$60,000 per person. So it is a wide range.
And the numbers I've seen from the RAND study, they suggest maybe $8 million a year. And that would be 0.018 of our budget. I mean, I think that people that aren't used to military budgets, like $8 million sounds like a lot. But FY18, we're asking for $639 billion.
It's crazy. Right? It's crazy. The healthcare, I mean, let's compare apples to apples, right? So the healthcare budget for the DOD was at $4.9 billion. Right?
Right.
And so the healthcare costs for transgender service members at the highest of the RAND estimate was $8.4 million. That's million with an M. But at the low end of that, it was $2.4 million. So when you pull that statistic apart, I'm not going to say that, you know, $8.4 million is nothing to sneeze at, right? But certainly in the frame of looking at the issue, it's not, you know, like the highest priority in cutting costs, at least from my position.
Right. And it's just not that much cost.
But, yeah.
And then I think that especially so the legal aspect that I've been struggling with the most is, so I believe 5 years ago, the military repealed Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
September 20th, 2011 was when it went into effect.
Oh my gosh, I'm getting
old. Almost 6 years.
6 years.
Yeah.
So then approximately 1 year ago, the Secretary of Defense, during that time, I believe it's fair to say that transgender service members had a de facto don't ask, don't tell. Do you think that's fair to say?
You know, I don't know if that's fair to say or not. I think that there was definitely an air of permissive ignorance, if you will.
Right, right.
You know, so commanders could, you know, kind of say, okay, well, you know, we're moving towards that. Let's not process this individual service member. But from a policy perspective, you know, I haven't looked at the numbers, but from a policy perspective, I think that there are still trans people who are getting discharged.
Well, I believe as of last, that should have stopped, you know, officially last year.
Yeah.
When Secretary of Defense Carter Ash, he sends out the directive that now transgender service members may serve openly and register that in DEERS, et cetera.
Yeah, that was June 30th of 2016. And he gave the services some time to kind of get some implementing guidance going on. And really, people started to transition about October of 2016. And, you know, all in all, you know, apart from, you know, some minor logistical issues, it's been just as much of a non-event as the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And from a military justice perspective, from a command perspective, it hasn't been this disruption that President Trump wants to allege that it is.
Now I'm going to embark on a fool's errand and try to understand what President Trump's tweets mean. Because he says, will not accept or allow transgender individuals to serve in any capacity in the U.S. military. So that means over the last year, transgender individuals were free to, you know, enter this into their records. They could request gender reassignment surgeries. So during that time, that was completely, they were open to do that. And now, are we to suggest that we're going to somehow separate these people? Because we lured them into saying, oh, well, you know, come forward, you know, register, you know, you can serve openly, and then use that against them later?
Absolutely. I mean, that's entirely what I see it as, is it's breaking faith with these service members who were brave enough at the vanguard of an era to come out. And some of them were encouraged by their commanders to come out. And now these individuals are being, potentially will be punished. Punishment, administrative separation is not a punishment. Let's put that in bold and italics, right?
Except if you've been in 18 years and, almost ready for retirement and have deployed numerous times. And then they say, oh, well, I hope you didn't want that retirement.
Yeah, I know trans individuals anywhere from, I don't think I know any privates, but I know Lance Corporals, and I know all the way up to Lieutenant Colonels who are serving today and who relied on our administration's assurances whenever they chose to come out. I mean, it's absolutely a betrayal of the faith that these service members put in their command to put into our military and then also into our nation. I think it's tragic.
Yeah, I think that just from the purely, not discussing the wisdom of this, but from the purely legal point of view, I think the commander-in-chief is probably fine in his powers to say we will no longer recruit transgender individuals. But the ability to kick people out or separate them, I'm not sure, it just as a due process matter that they've been led to believe that they could do this, and then we're using those statements against them.
Right. Detrimental reliance, Not getting too far ahead of the game here, but I think that the real solution here is through Congress. Article 1, Section 8 lays out the rights and responsibilities of Congress as it pertains to raising and maintaining an army and a naval force. And I think that the best solution here, even in this era of, partisan gridlock, is to submit a bill regarding open trans service and open LGBT service so that this is no longer open to the whims of the executive. I think that's the best solution. Is that going to happen? I'm cautiously optimistic. I don't know. Whenever I saw Senator Orrin Hatch from Utah come out in support of open trans service, I mean, my mind was blown.
Right.
Here's one, from a very fundamental religious stronghold who's coming out. And then, we also had senators from Alabama and a host of conservative Republicans came out in support of open trans service. And that gave me some hope.
Yes.
In what I would say are relatively dark times right now.
And, okay, so we've had the members can register that they, I think even can, they can register for their transition, if it's the medical necessity of that. What's your guess on the number who registered in the Marine Corps? I know that's a,
that would be definitely a swag, a scientific wild ass guess.
Yeah.
I think that it would be below 100 right now. And when we say register, they've gone to their command and they've requested a treatment plan regarding their transition and wherever they are in that treatment plan. I would say it's probably less than 100.
Yeah, so I have a friend of a friend who's at Manpower right now. It's 7 in the Marine Corps.
Huh.
So, not like you're saying that, definitely people have different paths they travel, in their transition, and maybe, people aren't ready for the medical procedures, but 7. You're telling me out of 182,000 Marines that, that burden of 7 people is just going to crush us?
Well, I do know a number for the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard was 13 because the Coast Guard commandant reached out and actually spoke to each one of them and told them that the Coast Guard was not going to break faith with them. So actually that, now that I've applied a little bit of intellectual rigor to that number. 7 doesn't seem out of the ordinary as it relates to other services.
And I'll tell you this, what the Coast Guard Commandant did, I'm of two minds about, because number one, I firmly believe in civilian control of the military. That I don't think it might be illegal, but I don't know that the President Trump's tweets were clearly illegal orders, that must be disobeyed. But I'm in favor of the outcome of that the commandant of the Coast Guard. You know what I'm saying? So it's difficult to reconcile those two, you know, that when the president speaks, the president issues orders. That's just it.
Well, we're in a brave new world as it pertains to Twitter as policy dissemination. I think it's incredibly difficult for the service chiefs to try to interpret 140 character tweets as, you know, policy edicts. So I didn't go as far as to think that the Coast Guard commandant was outside of his lane, because he didn't say that we're not going to keep not keep you out. He just said, you know, we're going to keep faith with you. And, you know, what I read that as is that he's going to do everything in his power to advocate for these service members in these upcoming policy decisions.
Yes, 140 characters is usually not a good way to issue laws. They tend to need to be a little more detailed.
They tend to be, yeah. Well, you know, to give President Trump a little bit of credit here, it was three separate tweets in 140 characters. So,
and you know what, though? The unfortunate part of this is, as much as it would be nice to do, you can't lay this all at the feet of the president, because our generals have been very, very poor barometers when it comes to social change in the military.
True.
I think there was 1,500 signatories to a letter opposing, you know, the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell from general and flag officers. And that's one of the things that bothers me about this current argument is, if you want to say conservative, or those that tend to be more conservative that are against, you know, transgender open service, where are there statistics to say that Don't Ask, Don't Tell has had a detrimental effect?
Right. Let's back up just a second. You know, there are three kinds of lies, right? There are lies, damn lies, and statistics.
Right.
And so you can mold statistics into, you know, basically whatever you want the outcome to be. So I don't doubt that there will be someone who will trot out some statistics in favor of the repeal of open trans service. In fact, Vicky Hartzler, Representative Hartzler, has already done that, and then tried to also retroactively apply that to Don't Ask, Don't Tell. That will not surprise me. It's sad. It's sad, but I don't think it'll surprise me. But, I mean, like I said a minute ago, I mean, it's been a non-event, you know?
Right.
You know, Marines bring their same-sex spouses or partners to, you know, unit family days or hails and farewells to dinings in. It's been shockingly nothing. But it has been amazingly awesome for our LGB and now T service members to be really authentic and to be able to share their entire existence with their command and with their troops so that, you know, they don't feel like they're holding something back. They're able to give 100%.
And I think I was still on active duty for a number of years after the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And like you say, it was a nothing burger. And I think that's attributable to a certain extent in the Marine Corps because we are the youngest service. We have very young population. And it just didn't seem to register with, you know, your average Lance Corporal. Like, it wasn't a problem.
Right. But that also applied to the other services. I mean, it was a nothing for in each of the services.
Right, right. I didn't mean to say that. Exclusion. Yeah, but it seems that you're serving members of the military. This is not an issue. You have, like, retired generals that, you know, it wasn't like that in Korea. And but they seem so out of touch with, because it was really this list of horribles, you know, before Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed, that we're going to lose this unit cohesion. It's going to be so horrible. If it was that bad, why haven't we seen any studies in the last 6 years suggesting that, like, this was the impact of Don't Ask, Don't Tell? It's right. They're not there.
They aren't there. And it would be the same for transgender service, is my firm belief. Because I think what it really comes down to is the idea of a transgender person serving versus knowing a person who is transgender and serving, right? I mean, you and I served together,
right?
For over a decade. I mean, well, you know, our services overlap,
right? But, right.
You know, each other for over a decade now, and you know who I am, right? You know the kind of work product I put out, you know the kind of Marine officer I was, and that doesn't change just because, you know, I wear the female, you know, service blouse. You know, that doesn't have any impact on my ability or capability to lead. And I think that when people see transgender service members in their command, and that's one of the reasons why I came out, is to kind of put this public face on it. When they have that lived experience of knowing someone who is trans and who's still able to do their job, who, you know, doesn't require a period of non-availability regarding deployments, or if that period, you know, exists, it's as short as they can make it. You know, these aren't people who are trying to skate on the government dime.
Breaker Audio. This is an ad, but not really. This is not a sponsor. This is just something I wanted to share with you, the listeners, because you, like me, are podcast fans. So I was listening to the podcast Track Changes, and they had on a great guest, Lee Culver. She's one of the founders of Breaker. Breaker is an app that you can use to listen to podcasts. I just started using it. It's really good. It's a mix between iTunes and Twitter and Facebook a little bit. So it learns what you've listened to. You're able to like it, and you're able to find similar shows that they recommend. Again, I'm not being paid to do this. This is just me sharing some of my podcasting experience with you. Go to Breaker, download it. Of course, it's free. And try it out. I think it actually just even functions better than regular iTunes. The pause and the going forward or backward 30 seconds just seems a little more fluid. And it's definitely better that you can comment and like podcasts. And of course, like Military Justice. Who doesn't? There's people that I know their service record and hear them opining about, well, this will break down small unit cohesion in battle. And I know that they've never been anywhere around that. And I know you have. I mean, you were during Phantom Fury or second Battle of Fallujah. I mean, well, tell us about that.
Sure. At that point, I was still enlisted, but I was the platoon sergeant of Scout Platoon attached to Regimental Combat Team 1. And we were involved in everyday fighting in Fallujah. I took an RPG to my truck on October 21st, 2004. That didn't, you know, just because I was trans, even though no one knew it at that point, that didn't change my ability to lead.
Yeah, I think that's what upsets me the most. It's because knowing people that, you know, I was either colleagues or acquaintances with, and hearing them talk about that, and I'm like, wait, I mean, I know Emma, that is just not the case. I mean, right. You're talking about, well, it destroys small unit cohesion. I'm like, how are you coming to that determination?
Well, it's that same parade of horribles that was trotted out for every other social advancement as pertained to the military. You know, integration of women, you know, moving from WACs to actually them being, you know, in the regular Army or in the Marine Corps. Integration of racial minorities in units, women in combat. These same tropes, these same tired tropes are being trotted out, you know, as this distraction, right? This kind of like shiny object. But all of this stuff is going to happen when, in fact, after each one of these movements forward, and I will categorize each of those as movements forward.
Oh, for sure.
That none of those parades of horribles have happened.
No, yeah, exactly. Like, if you were to stand up and say, like, you know, this racial integration of the military has really been a bad thing. I mean, I can't imagine. Oh, God, maybe there's somebody that says that.
All I would see are, like, chins dropping across.
Right.
What?
Yeah. But our general officer corps and retired generals, they were kicking and screaming when there was testimony after President Truman had repealed that. The Marine Corps is defending our segregated service, and I think out of 14,000 Marine officers. We had one black officer.
Yeah.
And they're still saying, like, yes, this is a good system and we need to keep it in place. And I think that that's the same thing with, I mean, we have not seen a problem with the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I mean, I'm not going to believe we have a problem until someone shows, you know, a verifiable study that we have. Right. And this, to me, is the same issue. It's just this, well, it makes us uncomfortable factor. I mean, that's what they're boiling it down to, is this gut feeling of, well, these generals are saying, well, you know, it'll be bad for the unit. And I know because that's my gut feeling. But they were proven wrong. Don't ask, don't tell.
Yeah.
It just went the wrong way. That, okay, this should be now a list of people we don't listen to. Their intuition isn't good.
Well, I can point to some specific examples of trans people who came out post the repeal and open service, and they've been amazing, amazing service members. Look at Staff Sergeant Logan Ireland from the Air Force. There is no way that you would look at that man and say, you're not mission capable.
Right.
And Sergeant Ken Ochoa, who just reenlisted. I mean, after the tweets from President Trump and the potential impact that will have on him, he raised his right hand and said, you know what? I'm still going to serve. And he's a drill sergeant in the Army. You have people like Staff Sergeant Patricia King, who's an infantry woman in the regular Army and kicking butt and taking names. She's a platoon sergeant. You know, amazing, amazing people. And that's just, you know, a few examples. Well, actually, Lieutenant Commander Blake Drimmon in the United States Navy, still doing an amazing job at his work despite these distractions, right? And that's really what these tweets are. They're the disruption. It's not the service of our trans service members that's the disruption. It's this kind of, oh, what's the word I'm looking for? I can think of a word. I don't want
to. Right, I was going to say, yeah, everyone that was coming to mind, I want to keep it PG-13.
Yeah, exactly.
But I would say also, on the retired side, Kristen Beck, along with you, has also been a great example of, wait a second, I served my entire career as a SEAL, and everything was okay. Let's everybody calm down.
And let's be honest about Senior Chief Beck. Not just a SEAL. She was in DEVGRU. She was SEAL Team 6. And so, like, when you look at the echelons of, you know, badassery, right?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that's the pinnacle, right? She was among the best of SEALs, which are among the best of our entire U.S. military. So to say that we're not capable of bringing the fight to the enemy and being lethal, effective service members who contribute to our warfighting capability is ridiculous.
I think that people, they tend to be black and white about this and say, well, you know, if you have a transgender service member, they're going to have all these medical costs. They'll be, you know, taken out of the fight for long periods of time with these surgeries, and that they will detract from the unit. And it's the worst when I know of female service members making this argument, because out of that same RAND study, I think female troops across the services, 30% more likely to be hospitalized. If you add in childbirth, 57% more likely to be hospitalized. So if we're just going with this, we've got to get the lowest cost body in there, then what's the justification for women serving?
But that never should be the calculus.
Never.
I mean, you know, our service members are not, you know, are not subject to contracting, you know, like the lowest bidder.
Right.
Definitely shouldn't be. Or we're definitely going to get what we pay for. But I understand your point. And, you know, it's a valid point. I mean, I like to use my own personal experiences. So in 1996, we were at Fort AP Hill, Virginia. I was with 1st Battalion, 2nd Marines, and we were doing workups for our upcoming float. And myself and Lance Corporal Griffin decided that it was way too cold outside to go outside. So we thought it would be a really great idea to wrestle on concrete, right?
Yeah, of course.
Marine infantryman.
Right.
And so he hip tossed me and I broke my my left arm, radius and ulna, 2 plates, 12 screws later. And I thought I was going to be non-deployable, right? Busted my butt. through physical therapy, and I deployed in April of 97 on the USS Kearsarge. That same kind of mentality goes towards openly trans people right now. When if they're going to have a surgery, they don't want it to impact their command.
Right.
They don't, and the vast majority of them don't want to be non-deployable. They want to deploy, just like, you know, most other Marines. You know, is there going to be, you know, some people who, you know, are trying to skate by? Sure. But those people exist regardless of gender identity.
Right, right. Along those same lines, do you remember the it was a thing going around the internet for a while where there was usually young enlisted Marines where they were running across the barracks and then jumping and kicking the other one in the chest when they were wearing a flak?
Yeah.
That was and you could watch hundreds of those. The Marines with any time to spare will get into mischief and usually end up breaking something.
The most dangerous thing in the world is a Marine and free time.
Yes, that is very
true. Or boredom. Yeah, a Marine and boredom. Yeah.
So, back to the legal issues. Are you representing anybody that has had this issue come up yet? Or is it probably just hasn't gotten into the stream yet?
Yeah, and this is actually a little bit of a segue here. But the reason why I'm not representing anyone who's trying to fight this right now is because I'm not taking new clients right now. Because I just finished my – so I was TDRL, the Temporary Disabled Retirement List from PTSD and Major Depressive Disorder. I'm not shy about owning those issues and the struggle that I had with them. I just had my TDRL reevaluation on June 30th. And, you know, after the conversation with the doc, she's most likely going to find me fit. So I have a choice. You know, if the PEB concurs with her findings, then I'll have a choice on whether or not to come back in or not.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And so for our listeners, generally what that is there was a condition that Emma, they separated you for, and then they put you on a temporary retired list. And so when they took that second look, they've now determined that, or at least the initial doctor said that you could be fit to return to duty.
Correct. Yeah. And so right now I'm not taking new clients because I think, you know, my ethical obligation
sure.
to zealously represent them, you know, there's the possibility within, you know, the next 3 months or so that I could be going through the process to put the uniform back on.
Wow.
So I want to find out from the PEB, no kidding, ominous, dominus, what they're going to say, the physical evaluation board.
Right, PEB. Right.
And then I'll make the determination on how to go forward. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, so these tweets and this potential policy stuff impacts me directly.
Right, right. Like, would you want to return to service knowing that there's tweets saying, well, we want to kick you out?
Right.
You fall in that Venn diagram. You would be among the people they want to kick out. And yet the bureaucracy is also saying, well, but we'd like you to return to service.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Kind of crazy.
Oh, yeah.
Going back to the legal arguments, you know, I don't think that what President Trump tweeted out was illegal. I definitely think that there's some avenues of attack, both on the, you know, administrative side and also on the legal side, you know, attacking it in a courtroom. I know ACLU is gearing up for a fight. I know that Lambda Legal is also gearing up for a fight. And I think that they're going to try to do a temporary injunction to begin with, and continue to fight to get this policy, the current policy, which is open trans service, get some solidity to that so that, you know, service members can move forward on their career and not have this be a disruption.
Right, right. I can see that being successful, but I'm not too optimistic on the courts actually overturning the ban because they were happy to sit quietly by for 20 years with Don't Ask, Don't Tell and leave that in place.
Right. But I think the difference here is that there has been a period of open service.
Right, right. No, that's definitely for those members serving during that time.
Yeah.
I think that they are in a much different legal position than those maybe individuals that would think about coming in, you know, so I
Right. Yeah. Accessions versus currently serving, I think is an interesting difference. And definitely they're on different legal footing.
You've heard the names before. Daryl Massey, Fred Hanna, Christina Gutierrez. You know the location.
The arrest began this morning of about a dozen Baltimore City police officers.
But have you heard this name?
This call is from
Richard Nicholas,
an inmate at a Maryland correctional facility. This call will be recorded and monitored.
A 2-year-old girl was murdered.
From moment one, she just laughed and smiled. She was a beautiful baby. And nothing mattered but getting to know her. And she was just like a ray of light. I mean, she was just a breath of fresh air. She was just, oh my God, she was like an angel.
And her father was convicted. Did you kill her?
No, I did not. I did not shoot my daughter.
Subscribe now to Convicted, coming late April. More information at convictedpod.com.
I don't want to get, you know, tell me if anything is too personal, but I think that a lot of people view this as though transgender people would be joining and, you know, they would have to put this down on, you know, their initial medical screening, as though your identity as being transgender was like your blood type, you know, that it was this unchanging constant about you. It doesn't seem to me that that's, or you tell me if that's how it is. It seems like there a lot of individuals have to, it takes them a while to actually grasp this or that aspect of themselves.
Yeah. Well, I would say that, you know, there's some studies going on regarding the biology versus, you know, nurture versus nature on, you know, why trans people exist. But I think that it's a generally recognizable fact that people transition at different stages in their life due to a whole host of different things. Primarily, one of the primary ones of those is social pressure. So people don't transition because they're afraid of the social implications, whether that be family, friends, or work, and that's what delays the coming out. So it's not that they haven't been trans the entire time. It's just now that they're coming to grips with that part of their self. I think it would be a challenge to have that as part of the forms, you know, the enlistment documents, you know, are you trans? And to have that be successful in keeping trans out. Because, you know, when I was 18 and signing that document, I would have written down no.
Sure.
And that would have been, you know, truthful because I was trying to, you know, I thought that I could, you know, be a man, right? And I didn't want, you know, quote unquote, want to be transgender. So, you know, it's not that that would have been a fraudulent enlistment, but I think that that's going to be a challenge to, you know, keeping trans people out.
Yeah, that's one of this argument, again, I should probably stay off social media, but that's one of these arguments that I've been hearing that, like, well, it would be different if, you know, it's a medical condition that you develop, you know, during your service, or if it exists when you're in a session. I'm like, how can you do, like, maybe, you know, maybe the person says, like, listen, I just plan to do one enlistment, get my GI Bill and go to college. And I just, I'm not going to mention this aspect of me during that 4-year period, you know?
Right. Oh, where do you even begin with that? Well, first of all, being trans isn't communicable, right? You're not going to catch it, you know, by serving with another trans person. And so it's not a condition that will develop, right? It's not a condition that will be created as, you know, as part of your military service. I think that it's a challenge for any trans person to come to grips with that aspect of their lives, whether they're, you know, 4 years old, 10 years old, or 40. So, I think that trans people, you know, like I said at the beginning of this interview, that trans people have been serving in our military since the get-go, and that they'll continue to. It's just a question of whether we want our policy to dictate that people shouldn't be authentic. I mean, that's pretty terrible.
Yeah.
At a policy standpoint.
And as you said, going back to personal things, I have a former boss who had served the vast majority of his career under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And while he was a gay man. And then, so the last, you know, 6 years of his, 5 years of his career, he was able to serve openly. And the benefit that that individual accrued, you know, that was a burden for so many years to have to serve in the closet. And he was just all around happier. And, you know, because just little things like saying, oh, you know, I went with my boyfriend or girlfriend to see a movie. You had to protect to not say that. Oh, no, I went with a heterosexual workout partner. And, you know, that was definitely, I mean, I can't speak directly for him, but I could say that that was definitely a burden for a long time. And to be relieved
well.
Of that. Yeah.
Yeah. The label that I put on my sexuality is queer, but if you're going to, you know, drill that down into one of the more definitive ones, it's bisexual. And so, I mean, while I was on active duty, I dated both men and women, and switching pronouns is terrible. I mean,
right.
it was absolutely terrible.
That is a problem with the English language. We need a gender neutral pronoun. Could England get on that, or whoever invents language?
Yeah, I know, right? But yeah, I mean, it was such a mental load. Like, it was stressful, you know, having to lie about where I was going out. You know, so when we value integrity as a, you know, a hallmark of our military service, we shouldn't force people to lie about, you know, consensual adult activities that have really no bearing on their ability to lead their Marines.
I always find that a little bit funny and disingenuous, that especially the Marine Corps, very apt to adopt a lot of the Spartan military traditions. Except
right?
For, right, like, wait a second. Homosexuality was integral to their military training. Oh yeah, but we can't like that. The other stuff, like running or something like that. But this other stuff makes us feel weird.
Bring home your, you know, with your shield or on it, you know,
that
makes sense, right? But, you know, going to dinner with your boyfriend, if you're a dude, you know, that's somehow antithetical to our military history. It makes no sense whatsoever.
Yeah, and that's really what we're left with. Because the argument, I've only heard the monetary argument really in the last, you know, in the last week. But if you take away the monetary argument, which I think is a pretty weak one, it's really boils down to, well, I would feel weird. It's an ick factor. That's why we don't want it. And it's just such a tiny read of an argument, you know, to suggest that that's why you're going to end people's careers. That's why you're going to not allow them the benefits of serving in the military. That's why we're going to exclude this talent pool of individuals. Just, well, I would kind of feel icky.
Yeah, and the ick factor is, I think it's incredibly dismissive of the vast majority of our troops. You know, because, you know, they use the ick factor for, you know, gays and lesbians not being able to serve. You know, I can't, you know, I don't want to look at a dude holding hand with another dude, you know, as, you know, some sort of talisman to say why, you know, gays and lesbians shouldn't be able to serve. And then the proof in the pudding is that, you know, like I said before, people are bringing their spouses, their significant others who are in same-sex relationships to command-sponsored events. And it's nothing. So I think it really comes down to knowing the individuals who are trans or LGBT and being able to relate to them on an individual level rather than some abstract, you know, I don't want to serve with them because, you know, he shouldn't be wearing a dress kind of mentality.
Well, yeah, and then, shoot, we had that with everyone's favorite general, Jim Amos, saying that right at the end with Don't Ask, Don't Tell, coming back and saying, like, well, you know, you will visit graves in Arlington Cemetery because of this action. Is that, I don't know that that's come to pass yet.
No, it hasn't, and I don't suspect it will.
So on the legislative side, what's going on? Is there anything currently in Congress? Is anyone working on this now?
Not to my knowledge. I don't have a really good pulse on the legislative front right now, but I'm not aware of any bill that's being drafted to protect trans service members.
And it seems like the military has kind of ignored the president's tweets to a certain extent because they don't seem to have done any implementing guidance.
Well, it's because it's not policy yet. I mean, I think that it's entirely within the, you know, the correct outcome to right. not try to implement, you know, three tweets and start kicking people out. So, you know, there's been some news reports regarding, you know, the White House meeting with Department of Defense officials to figure out the way forward.
Right.
But there's been very few, if any, you know, quote unquote leaks about the substance of those talks. So, you know, having served with General Mattis, now Secretary of Defense Mattis, I know he's an amazingly smart individual who doesn't make rash decisions. So I'm hopeful that he will approach this situation with the same kind of intellectual rigor that he's approached problems in the past. And I think that if that happens, then the right outcome will come out of this. And I'm hopeful that, that Secretary Mattis pushes back on the White House regarding the ouster of trans service members.
I think that if one honestly looks at the history of integration of all these different groups in the military, that you come to the conclusion that it's always been better for us, that it's made us a better military, that we have a bigger talent pool to draw from.
Yeah. Yeah. And diversity has been proven to enrich the lives of not just the diverse people, but also the majority. It makes people better leaders.
I can't tell you how much this means to me because, I mean, honestly, my friendship with you and you were there for me in my hour of need, it really, when these tweets came out and I saw the reactions, it just sickened me that I'm like, what, you people are just, it's as though it was just pent up and they were just, rah, ready to jump on it. And it really, it's nice that you could come on and talk about this because I think it's very important to get your story out.
Well, for me, your friendship, mentorship, and support over the years has been invaluable to me. So thank you for affording me the opportunity to speak with you about this, I think, very crucial topic.
So what do you think? What's the chance of you going back on active duty?
If you would have asked me in June, I would have said, you know, 90%. I'm honestly, I don't know.
And that's what I think is so reckless about this tweet, that you are putting so many people's lives in turmoil.
Yeah.
Right. Like you have to determine a career path. Wait, do I still want to nurture my private practice, or am I going to go back into military service? Yeah. And these things take, you know, it keeps people in kind of the limbo for long periods of time just because you decided to tweet something out.
It's incredibly disrespectful and callous towards our service members. So,
yeah, we definitely owe them a little more deliberation before making such radical changes to their lives.
Yeah. And, you know, that's what I appreciate about, you know, former administrations is even if I didn't agree with what their policy decisions were, I knew that there was rational discussion and intelligent thought being directed at the problem.
Right. Yeah. It's like if you go back to women in infantry or combat roles, there were shoot, I was still on active duty down at McCitic at the time, and there were huge working groups, you know, actually studying this and having a deliberative process. Like, you might not agree with the end state, but they had committed resources and personnel, and they were actually studying this, not just firing from the hip.
Right. And I'm hopeful that that will continue.
Yes. Well, where can people follow you on social media, etc.?
I'm not on Twitter very often. It's a lot of noise. Maybe I'm too old.
No, Twitter's good. You should be on Twitter more.
I love, believe me,
both your that Pantsuit Nation article that just came up about you was fantastic. I'll make sure I get that out to everybody. And you really are good on social media, because I was really taken aback and very heartened when, you know, you talked about your first year of transition.
Well, I have the ability to follow me on Facebook.
Okay.
And so, you know, if you search Emma Shin, you know, it'll pop up. I've been, you know, there's deluge of friend requests right now.
Oh, that's good.
I've got like, you know, 150 people in the queue. And I only have it open to friends of friends. They're the only ones who can see the
button. This is why you need to be on the Twitters. You would have, I mean, then it's easier for people to follow you, and it's not as much of a burden. God, your story needs to get out there. I'll end it with that. But I will definitely put up your Facebook page, your practice, or actually you're kind of in limbo on your practice, but sure, you want me to list that also?
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah, defendingdefenders.com is my website.
Great.
And I do have a Twitter account. I'm just never on it. I don't even know what my...
Well, fix that.
My Twitter Twitter handle is... I think it's Aggie Jag. Yeah, it's at Aggie Jag. AggieJag.
Perfect. I'll put that up there. Thank you. Military Justice is a production of Long Arc Digital Media. There are numerous people that need to be thanked for making Military Justice possible. First of all, audio. Those are the people that clean up all the mistakes I made. Hannah McCarthy, she takes care of that. Methil Telhan, she takes care of everything. She keeps the show moving along and keeps all of us on schedule. Executive producer is Dennis Robinson. You know him from Undisclosed and The Wearing of Underwear. And as always, Uber producer Dreadnought has my six.